by our company. This year marks the 8th anniversary of the scholarship. It was established in 2006 in memory of the late Ken Borick to honor his contribution to aviation. The scholarship is open to Western and Northern students of aviation, and I would like to acknowledge the work of Naomi Nin, Stephen Norris, Terry Archuk, and Colin Dempsey, who receive all of these applications that come in from the applicants, and they go through a fairly serious review process and ranking, and reduce the list down to three candidates. Those three candidates are offered to Mrs. Borick, who chooses the winner. And the quality of individual that we're getting speaks to a tremendous future for Northern Aviation, because these people are nothing short of magnificent, and it's really exciting to see the enthusiasm and the desire and the passion for aviation from these young people. The recipients of the scholarship in previous years have included four pilots, an aircraft maintenance engineer, an avionics technician, and one pilot engineer. I'm very pleased to announce this year's scholarship is being awarded to Bailey Simonuk. She's 22 years old. She calls Marsh Lake, Yukon, home. I don't know where Marsh Lake is, but it must be close to Whitehorse. Among her many accomplishments, she works with Air North as a flight attendant, and I'm told she regularly achieved a perfect score on the exams and hands-on drills while in training. So while working with Air North, she decided that her true calling was to be an aircraft maintenance engineer. She has been accepted into the Northern Lights College AME program in Dawson Creek starting in September of this year. The application that these people put in include quite an outline of their accomplishments. Typically, these people have pretty high marks in school. They do a tremendous amount of community work. It's really quite astonishing to see at that age what people do. I haven't made a list here, but just to give you an idea of the kinds of things this young lady's done, if I could find a page here. In grade 11, she presented 80 different presentations on northern environment and social topics to audiences of between 4 and 1,000 people. She's a speaker at high-profile events like the Canadian Arctic Summit and Global Youth Assembly. She's received volunteer awards, the Canada Day Youth Award, the Superintendent's Award of Excellence, Canadian Climate Champion, the Climate Project Presenter. She's been a youth group leader in Iglulik. She was a national coordinator of the Isabella Bay Action Group, Polar Perspectives Facilitator, working with students on ice, presenting workshops on the north in the Yukon and in Alberta. Her goal was to visit 20 countries by the time she was 20 years old, and she did that. So I guess aviation is a good profession. It just goes on and on and on. I joined the volunteer fire department in my rural community because aviation firefighting interests me a great deal. So pretty amazing individual, and we're quite happy that we'll be able to spend that money on her education. So a big thank you to NATA for assisting with the administration of this scholarship, and thank you for the opportunity of announcing the winner.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, so Bob, I'm going to need assistance from you for 1 second just to take the front off the PowerPoint there. Oh, what do we got? What do we got? Oh. I should have had Rod Wood do the first one. So it is my pleasure to introduce to you our guest speaker for the 37th Annual Conference and Trade Show of the Northern Air Transport Association, Mr. Bob Cameron, or as I like to call him, my friend Bob. So a bit of background on Bob Cameron for the folks who don't know him. He was born May 10 in 45 in Edmonton, Alberta. He arrived in the Yukon in May of 46 as his parents relocated back to Whitehorse after the war. Attended 12 years of public school in Whitehorse, graduated from F.H. Collins Secondary School, graduated from University of British Columbia in 69 with a degree in mechanical engineering, attained private pilot's license while he was in grade 11, and attained commercial pilot license in 1970 while working at Canadian Pratt & Whitney in Montreal. His career, 34 years with Transnorth Turbo Air as a commercial pilot, flying both fixed wing and helicopter. For 30 of those years and up to retirement in 2001, was company ops manager. Was inducted in 2002 as an honorary life member and was presented by his good friend Don Douglas for the award. So I have to say, I remember my first NATA meeting in Whitehorse and meeting so many people and trying to get a handle on the whole, you know, aviation language. And at the end of the board meeting, we were in the Transnorth boardroom, and this guy, Bob, turns to me and says, "Now, Mary, you probably don't know this, but I have a beaver." "Would you like to see it?" Yeah, I don't know if I... Oh, how do I... this. Hang on, sorry. Okay, that was my friend Bob I forgot to show. There he is as our honorary life member. Here we go. Anyways, I never did go for a ride in the beaver, but I learned the aviation language at that time. So Bob has recently published a book in the early history of commercial aviation in the Yukon Territory called Yukon Wings, which we are looking forward to hearing about. Presently restoring two early Yukon bush planes for the Yukon Transportation Museum. And he is also currently the Deputy Commissioner of the Yukon. That's a busy retirement life. Bob is married to Lois, and together they have two sons, Kyle and Fraser. Bob and Lois spend the summer months cruising the rivers of SE Alaska, Southeast Alaska, in their CHB sedan-style trailer. Ladies and gentlemen, author of the Yukon Wings, Mr. Bob Cameron. Now, do you want me to set yours?
Yep.
We might need Jeff.
We might need Jeff to set us up here.
There we go. And that's...
And all you had to do is use a clicker forward, just hit that. To put it on the screen?
To up or on the screen, whatever you want. I can put it now if you want.
Oh, no, I'll let you know. Well, thank you, Mary, for all those kind words. And thank you all for your warm welcome and good evening. Before I begin, I'd like to thank NATA for inviting me to join you at this AGM. I haven't been to an AGM for a number of years now, so it's great to see a lot of old friends again. And I'd certainly like to thank Alcan Air for providing me with a ride over here. Tonight, I wanted to give you all a break away from the mental gymnastics of air regs and SMS and CARAC and Canada Labor Code, all that good stuff, and look at our northern aviation story from a historic perspective. and will be particularly focusing on the Yukon. Growing up in the Yukon in an aviation family in the 1950s, I pretty early at an early age became aware that there's a tremendous story to be told of the Yukon aviation legacy, how the Yukon got the reliable commercial air service that we have today. I recognized this at a very early age, and I kind of resolved to myself that I'd like to someday tell that story, put that in a book, and also retrieve some of the old airplanes, do some restorations, and in general preserve this fabulous history, second to none in the world, really. So November of 2012, I did get the book published. You can put that slide on now, Jeff, and then I think I'll be away. I'll be solo. So I could strike that off my bucket list. The book, as I say, it's the story, the untold story of the development of commercial aviation in the Yukon. A lot of it takes place during the 1930s when they had fierce competition going on between the BYN company, which was owned by White Pass. You've all heard of the White Pass with their railway and their steamboats. They had an airline, and they butted heads with a guy down in Carcross named George Simmons, who had Northern Airways. And so much of my book covers the colorful rivalry that ensued between these two companies, and they no sooner made an uneasy peace between them, and along comes a guy named Grant McConachy to really stir things up. So the book is about the fabulous airplanes of the day, the feisty, gutsy characters that pioneered the early air services and had, as I say, sometimes a not very friendly rivalry. In the Yukon, we had some of the rarest of airplanes. There were some aircraft that were never seen in service anywhere else in Canada, only in the Yukon. And the book covers all of this kind of history. Here you've got the Curtiss Condor, virtually as big as a DC-3 with a second wing on it. At the time that it was based in Whitehorse, serving all the Yukon communities in the late 30s and early 1940s, it was the largest airliner in Canada. Wasn't the most modern, and it wasn't the fastest, but it was the biggest. So the book has 350 pages and 650 photographs of this untold story. And some of you have maybe seen it out here at the registration desk. We have 60 copies of it here in hopes that some people might want to buy one. I think Colin mentioned that tomorrow morning I'll join him out at the desk to sign copies if you'd like me to desecrate the inside page of your book. So much for the commercial. I'm not really going to talk any more about the book per se. Let the book speak for itself and stand on its own merits. What I want to do tonight is focus more on some of the things we've been able to do to preserve our Yukon aviation history. And some of this I have to go over very quickly because we're running late and I don't want to be still up here talking to you at midnight and everybody's sound asleep. Excuse me. Any of you who've been to Whitehorse, and maybe some who've not, will be aware and familiar with this monument we put up in the 70s of a DC-3. As like all DC-3s, it's had a great, long, colorful history. In the case of this one, it pioneered scheduled air services all across Canada for 30 years. And we were able to put it up on a rotating pedestal. It's a weather vane. It always points dead into wind. Virtually a world-class monument. There's no other large airplane in the world that's been placed on a single central mount like that. So I do get letters and calls from all corners of the world as to how we did it. Israel, Australia, England, and it's featured in magazines all over the world. So it's one thing that we were able to do. In 1986, the theme of Expo 86 was the history of transportation. And the Yukon government decided to commission a guy down in the Gulf Islands to build a full-sized replica of the first commercial airplane in the Yukon. It was known as the Queen of the Yukon, and had a very short-lived career, but made history every day that it flew. It ended up in the garbage dump. Nobody was thinking in those days of preserving any of that history, so we didn't end up with any of it, any of the original airplane. But at the end of Expo, we asked the government to bring their replica up to Whitehorse and let us see if we could promote the idea of a transportation museum. As you can see, it's a pretty good looking replica there. We put it on a truck and paraded it through town during the Sourdough Rendezvous Parade. We were successful eventually. You can see here that we have now a transportation museum. The DC-3 monument was recently relocated to the front of the museum, and hanging in the main hallway of our museum is the replica of the Queen of the Yukon. Now, I mentioned Northern Airways. They began the very first reliable air service in the Yukon, 1933. And this is their operation photographed at Carcross during the war. At that time, they were operating the Waco, which you see in the foreground, BDZ, and a fleet of these vintage Fairchilds. Even at the time they came to Carcross in the 1940s, they were already obsolete antiques. But they're in great demand to meet the needs of the American Army, Canal Project, and the Alaska Highway Project. Today, I'm spearheading the restoration of both these airplanes. Of the fleet of Fairchilds that Northern Airways operated, after the war, they eventually each came to an end somewhere. None of them were fatal accidents, but the aircraft were quickly pushed aside and written off. And interestingly, BXF lasted the longest and soldiered on into 1963 before it came to a demise in a coastal inlet north of Vancouver. By that time, it was the last working Fairchild in the world. By the time I got a hold of it, it had its accident. It had been dragged out of the salt water and stripped and not properly flushed out, so it was rapidly deteriorating with corrosion. But it took me 35 years to convince the museum owners to give it to me, let me bring it back to the Yukon and restore it for the Yukon. Some of you here that have been in the industry a long time will remember the name Ed Zaleski. Ed and Rose Zaleski were running the museum that owned it at that time, when I first started bugging them about letting me bring it back to the Yukon. Anyway, as I say, I have to gloss over some of this. That's the status of it now. It's on display in the museum as a work in progress. It's most of it's now ready for fabric. I wonder how this little pointer works. Oh, pretty nice. So you can see one of the features of those early Fairchilds was they all had folding wings. And we've retained that feature with our airplane, and it's coming along pretty good. Going back to that photo, the other one I'm restoring is the Waco in the foreground, and here's another shot of it. It's got quite a long, colorful history in the Yukon. It was purchased brand new in 1938 and brought to Carcross to start a scheduled air service from Vancouver to Dawson. We have all the log books, and the airplane did make 6 round trips, revenue trips with passengers, Vancouver to Dawson. But it didn't really catch on. One trip took 2 weeks. You know, people. And halfway along, at the midway point at Burns Lake, you had to get out and help the pilot change over from skis to wheels if you were heading to Vancouver. And vice versa if you were heading north. So it didn't really catch on. And McConaughey was after that route as well, and he'd come up with some faster airplanes, a little more modern, and of course we know the rest. McConaughey got the route, and that all became Canadian Pacific Airlines. Anyway, I'm now endeavoring to restore this one as well, just for its history. After a long, colorful career, it came to a fiery end, not a crash. It just caught fire on startup on floats. And poor old George Simmons was so upset and undone by it, he just stripped it and flung it into the bush. And by the time I caught up to it, that's what it looked like. Had trees growing through it and everything. But you can see here, this past summer, we had it, both Fairchild and the Waco, on display as works in progress. So those are two of the things that are keeping me busy these days during my retirement. A quick glimpse into a future project. We recently found the remains of the very first helicopter in the Yukon. It had come to grief on a mountaintop north of Dawson City in 1952. The crew walked out and were rescued, and the thing was completely forgotten about. It's off the beaten track. It hasn't been visited by anybody. And we're making plans now to retrieve it. And I've tracked down where I'm going to be able to get parts for it. And I'm hoping to restore it to look like it did when it came to the Yukon in 1949 and commence the topo survey for mapping the Yukon north of Dawson and Mayo. For those of you who are helicopter-minded, you'll recognize it's a Hiller. It's the predecessor to the famous Hiller 12E. It's a Hiller 360. And it's not real evident in the photo, but the cyclic control, which in most aircraft, including helicopters, usually comes up through the floor, and of course you push forward to get the nose down and pull back to raise the nose. This thing's so old that they couldn't figure out how to get all that control down and up through the bottom, so they brought it straight from the mast and down through the top. So the pilot, to raise the nose, pushed the stick forward. And to lower the nose, you pulled back. No wonder it crashed. Anyway, I just wanted to go over those quickly. By far and away, the most impressive and interesting restoration that we did was the rebirth of the Northern Airways Fokker Super Universal. So first, a little bit of background to put that type of aircraft into perspective for you. When the World War I was finished, and of course Germany had lost, and their main supplier of fighter aircraft was Tony Fokker, Fokker Aircraft. He was a Dutchman, not a German, but his main customer was the Luftwaffe. They lost the war, and he wasn't about to hang around with the losers. So he moved his Fokker plant to New Jersey and immediately went about building civilian aircraft. He built this airplane here and produced it in large numbers, called it the Fokker Universal. It was quite an advance for the day. Single wing, whoops, I'll go back here a bit. Single wing, not a biplane, so you're not dragging a lower wing through the bush. It was adaptable to skis and floats. It had a comfortable closed cabin for four passengers, and the pilot, though, was still out in an open cockpit. And here you see Grant McConaughey. He started his aviation career with a fleet of these little Fokker Universals. This is another one of his Fokker Universals. In this picture, it's taxiing on Chestermere Lake at Calgary. And I just want to draw your attention for a moment to the registration in the early days of Canadian aviation. We were still very much a colony in the mother country. Great Britain generously gave us part of their system. Their system's G-4 letters. So for Canada, they assigned G-CA and two more letters. So the only unique part of the registration from aircraft to aircraft was the last two letters. So they were usually referred to by their last two letters. So this aircraft was affectionately known as FU. Anyway, the type was a very successful machine. The government put four of them up in the Arctic way back in the early 20s, and they explored the Northwest Passage. It was apparent to Tony Fokker that he could build further on the design and build an improved model. And he put a young engineer on the job, and they upgraded it to what they called the Fokker Super Universal. And It was quite an improvement. It was half again as big. The cabin carried 6 passengers in comfort. The cockpit was now closed in and could seat 2 pilots side by side. It had twice the horsepower and quickly proved to be a very good airplane and a good airplane up in the bush country. There were about 80 of them built, of which 38 came into Canada, so almost half the total fleet came into Canada. And of that, a dozen or so were actually built in Canada, in Montreal, under license. Western Canada Airways, in 1928, based in Winnipeg, started their business. They had money. The Richardson family had money to start the company with. So they bought 10 of these brand new Fokker Super Universals and brought them into Canada and immediately commenced pioneering their famous mail routes into the Northwest Territories, down the Mackenzie River, and generally pushing back the frontiers of isolation in a big way. So this was one of Fokker's advertisements, and he grabbed onto the fact that historically his aircraft were really conquering the vast distances of Canada's north. As I mentioned, Western Canada Airways bought 10 of them, and here's one of them here, out on the job along the Mackenzie somewhere. Among the many pioneering flights, history-making flights, the most famous, of course, was Punch Dickens' flight, a 4,000-mile flight across the unmapped barren lands of the Northwest Territories. There he is when he was a young guy in his prime and working the Fokker Super Universal up and down the Mackenzie River. This great painting depicts him flying that 4,000-mile flight across the barren lands, and it again is a Fokker Super Universal. Even Canada Post in recent years, I guess we can tell by when was the price 60 cents for a letter, but in fairly recent years, Canada Post decided to honor the early bush airplanes that opened up Canada, and the Fokker Super Universal was certainly featured, and as you can see, a very nice stamp was made of it. So in 1929, the giant mining company, Cominco of Trail, BC, bought a brand new Fokker Super Universal to serve their mining camps and their far-flung exploration operations. Now here you can see it's behind the guys is the CF-AAM. 1929 was the year that the mother country turned us loose and said we can now have our own registration system, and Canada set up CF-AAM. 3 letters. So this airplane was obviously very early in the new system. In fact, with the letter M, it would make it the 13th airplane registered on the Canadian registry. That was 1929. 1934, they ran it for 5 years, and then they had a change of plans, and they started to downsize their very large aviation division. And they put AAM up for sale. Meanwhile, in Carcross, George Simmons on the left and Bob Randall on the right had leased a Fairchild 71 to test the waters and see if it was feasible to operate a commercial air service out of Carcross. Up to that point, everything had fallen on its face. Nobody had succeeded in providing a reliable air service. So they were trying it out to see if they could maybe pull it off. By the end of 1933, they had had a good summer with the Fairchild, and they said, let's go for it, we'll get rid of this leased airplane, and let's buy an airplane of our own. They made a deal with the Cominco company, and they bought AAM. They went down a trail, took off with it, flew it to Carcross, and Northern Airways was now in business with their own airplane. One of the first contracts it had, in the spring of 1935, they were serving the National Geographic Society expedition into the St. Elias ice ranges. Here we see the AAM on the Lowell Glacier, marking the first landing of an airplane on the Canadian side of the St. Elias ice fields. And this is on the same job, unloading some of the cargo, 1935. The Fokker was also used extensively for more routine work. Northern Airways, by this time, had established a regular mail service and air service to other isolated northern towns, in this case, Atland, BC. Now, again, I have to kind of gloss over this quickly. I could entertain you all night with the stories of this airplane and its colorful career, but like all of them, they eventually came to an unfortunate end somewhere along the line. In this case, certainly not fatal, but an overrun off the end of the runway attempting to take off at Dawson City. He was on wheels, had six people and all their gear on board, and there'd been a fresh snowfall of 6 or 8 inches of snow. And it ended up going in off the end of the runway and through a ditch and cleared the landing gear off. I guess he hadn't checked his balanced runway charts that day. It's always been a bit of a mystery to me why it was declared a write-off. The aircraft is really not damaged that badly, and it was not out in the wilderness anywhere. It was at Dawson City. But the Achilles heel on these Fokker Super Universals, for all the wonderful performance they had, the ability to lift a good load and get in and out on in short landings and takeoffs, the downside was that gigantic wing. It was all made of plywood. And any other airplane you want to think of that era, fabric-covered airplanes, had a wooden frame for a wing, much like a model airplane, you know, sticks and solid wood making ribs and spars, and then covered with fabric. And when the fabric got rotten or worn out, there weren't a lot of hangers in those days, so the weather was tough on them, you really just had to put a fresh layer of fabric. So that's why airplanes like the Norseman and Fairchild and that soldiered on way beyond these Fokkers. When the weather started to perish the plywood structure of these wings, you had nothing to repair. The whole wing was shot. So as wonderful an airplane as they were, they really did have relatively short careers. So I suspect that would be why this was written off. They must have been getting signs that the wing was not really going to be good for too many more years, so they decided it wasn't worth repairing it. In any case, the decision was made. They did get a write-off from their insurance company, and they stripped the undamaged wing and the engine and other parts, and they left the carcass of the fuselage at the Dawson Airport and just left it abandoned. George Simmons of Northern Airways went out immediately and bought another Fokker Super Universal, and in fact, another one, a third one, ATJ and AJC. He liked the airplanes, they did a good job for him. Again, I could write a book on the career of each of these airplanes. Very colorful, and they were both had created a lot of firsts and a lot of history all across Canada by the time they ended up at Carcross. But needless to say, eventually they too came to an end somewhere. Not fatal, no fatal accidents, but again, the aircraft quickly declared to be write-offs. Now, at this point, this is AJC, the third one, and this is 1942. So with AJC being struck off strength, that was the end of the Fokker Super Universal era, not only in Canada, but in the rest of the world. The airplanes had been used as far south as Antarctica. They had pushed back frontiers all around the world. But in 1942, with AJC coming to rest on her nose in the bush, that was the end of the Fokker Super Universals. I think the legacy of the Beaver and the Otter and the Norseman, the legacy's in good hands. Everybody's aware of those airplanes, what great bush planes they are and were. But it looked like history was going to forget the Fokker Super Universals. They were virtually extinct with AJC ending up being left in the bush as a wreck. People were moving on. There was nothing being saved for preservation. Not even Punch Dickens' famous CASK that he had done the historic flight across the Barren Lands. Not even it was saved. In 1933, it was accidentally burned during engine preheating with a blowpot. And that was the end of CASK. So I decided to, in the 1970s, I decided to round up the remains of the three that had died in the Yukon and see what we can do, whether we could restore one for static display or whether we could ever get one flying again. But I thought, at least I better, while I can, I better grab up what's out there. This is AJC, and it's actually just resting in the Carcross garbage dump. That's where it ended up, because they did drag it in from its crash site. So the retrieval of AJC was really quite simple. I just backed the truck up and loaded it on. The retrieval of AAM was a little more difficult. Somebody, and I don't know who or why, but somebody had hauled it away from its resting place at the Dawson Airport and hauled it 50 miles out into the bush and deposited it there. So when we went out with the helicopter, you couldn't land near it. So we hovered above the airframe. I wasn't flying the helicopter because I had to get out and gingerly step onto the airframe and bridle up the sling gear, and we pulled AAM out of the bush. There was nobody there to take a picture, but some cartoonist thought he had a pretty good idea what he thought it must have looked like. It wasn't quite that bad. Anyway, I ended up then with the remains of these three Fokker Soup Universals piled up in my backyard, much to the delight of my neighbors, and began to ponder what we could do next. In the meantime, I met this guy, Clark Seaborn. And you can see he's got a nice young family and a beautifully restored Waco airplane, which he had restored from basket case. We became good friends, and he was telling me he'd like to do another restoration, but he wanted it to be more special, more rare than Waco or Stearman. And I said, I got the project for you. And so we talked about what wreckage parts I had, and considered the great history of the airplane and the fact that none exists, and the decision was made to restore AAM. So here's the beginnings of the rebirth of AAM. It took place in Clark Seaborn's workshop in Calgary, behind his office in downtown Calgary, so I couldn't really participate in this one in a hands-on way. I could cheer him on and encourage him and supply him with parts and history and stuff, but Clark was pretty much on his own on the project. The reconstruction of the wing was a massive job and a hell of a challenge. It's all one piece, 51 feet long. At the fuselage end there, the cord is about 9 feet. The whole thing weighs 1,200 pounds. It's double tapered, under cambered, washed in on the trailing edge. He couldn't get more complexities into a wooden wing than that. But Clark was up to it, a heck of a craftsman. But at times he wondered what the hell he's gotten himself into. At times he did look overwhelmed. I'd encourage him and tell him it looks great. He couldn't see the progress, but I sure could. He'd forge on into the wee hours of the night, and here he is pounding in some of the 95,000 brass nails that had to go into that plywood wing. Once in a while, he'd find somebody who remembered the old Fokker Soup Universals and could give him a few pointers here and there. And here he's got the Sterrett Airways crew. Sterrett Airways was one of the outfits that CPA bought up when McConaughey formed CPA. And some of these old guys remembered, because they too, that year in 1942, they too operated the very last Fokker that year and had to scrap it because of the wings. So they certainly encouraged him. He managed to track down Punch Dickens, who was retired in Victoria. Punch, of course, was tickled that the old Fokker Soup Universal is being restored. And he was able to recall quite a bit of detail about the cockpit of the Fokkers he used to fly. So that was quite a big help. Anyway, you can see progress is being made here. And you see that great thick full span wing. The plywood cladding has now been applied to the bottom of the wing and is yet to be done on the top. And the fuselage frame, of course, is welded steel tubing. The front half was all originally AAM. So here's the fabric being applied to the fuselage. It's a large fuselage, so it had to be placed on a rotating spit like a barbecue so you could work on all four sides. And it's coming together here with some paint on it. And and the detailing. Now, this fellow fortunately came on board. His name's Don McLean, and he was the first engineer with Time Air. When Stubb Ross started with the Beech 18, Don was his engineer. He stayed with the company right through the buyout with Regional and all that stuff, and he's retired today. But fortunately for us, he came on side and had every evening available to work on the Fokker, and he's a tremendous asset. And voila. The caption to this photo is, "What a difference 20 years makes." In July of 1998, AAM took to the air for the first time in 61 years. Clark Seaborn was at the controls at the time. We tried to do it in the cloak of, well, not the cloak of darkness, but in the wee hours of the morning so nobody be around. You never know how these first flights are going to work out. But somehow the media sniffed it out, and it didn't take long for the airplane to start making headlines. And that went on for the next many years. Starting in 1999, the three of us flew that airplane 30,000 miles all over North America. Our first foray out into the air nav systems and all that from our little field outside of Calgary that we did all the test flying on was a safari off to Oshkosh. Most of you know Oshkosh is the biggest annual air show in North America. It hosts 10,000 airplanes and 1 million visitors. So here we are off to Oshkosh. Now, it was our first contact with the air nav system, having to talk on the radio and stuff like that. And we're heading for Medicine Hat because we got to top up our tanks. We couldn't get out of our little field with full tanks and all our gear and everything. So we're called into Medicine Hat and sounded like quite a young guy on the flight services. And he asked what type of aircraft. We said 1929 Fokker Super Universal. We had a long pause. He said, "What's your four-letter designator?" Well, called back, said, "Well, we don't have one of those. This thing's built in 1929. Yeah. Oh, he says, you got to have a four-letter designator put into our database. You know, I think, well, or what? We got to stay up here? We can't land or what, you know? Anyway, I keyed the mic and I said, "Well, how about Foxtrot, Oscar, Kilo, Uniform? Fuck you." There was quite a long silence, and then you keyed their mic, and you could hear them all laughing in the background. Yeah, and an older guy, more senior sounding guy, came on and said, "Oh, I think we can work with that." Anyway, we got to Oshkosh, and you can see the crowds gathered around the airplane. There's actually three photos here. There's the Fokker. They put us on the very front line. They really gave us a place of honor in this huge air show. This makes the photo a little confusing. It's actually the engine nacelle of this Ford Trimotor. It was taking people out for rides, and of course you could shoot photos from the airplane. So somebody took this photograph. It was the only one we ever did get of our airplane sitting there. But anyway, it shows you we did get to Oshkosh. And with the exposure of being in such a huge showplace, of course, the media, the aviation media, just went crazy. And they started using our airplane as the cover girl of all kinds of aviation magazines all around the world. The fact that it was from the Yukon added to its allure, I think. People could see this was a real dinosaur, this thing. And not only that, it's come from that mystique, faraway place called the Yukon. This is a French magazine. I think that translates into the Fokker of the gold mines. So. And this was another magazine. Part of the caption says, "In your wildest dreams, did you ever expect to see these four virtually extinct aircraft fly again. We finished off Oshkosh. We were there for a week. And when we left, they had awarded us with this Judge's Choice trophy. They give out all kinds of awards there for all kinds of categories. And they were pretty impressed with the rarity of our airplane and the horrendous job of bringing it back to life. So that was 1999. Now, 2000, we decided it was time to take AAM back to its very original roots, which was the Cominco Company and Trail BC. So here you can see the smokestacks and the pollution of Trail over the nose of the Fokker. We landed at the company airport, Columbia Gardens, little airstrip on the Columbia River, and we were quite surprised to discover that the very same hangar that AAM had been kept in back in 1929 was still there. Not only that, we knew that back in the old days when they had the Fokker, they had a fleet of those little de Havilland Puss Moths. And on our way to Trail, we ran into a guy who owned one. He had it restored and had it flying. He said, hey, I'll go with you. So we got a tremendous photo opportunity. I just want you to notice the hangar behind the airplane and that little bit of skyline you can see of the mountains. There's the same spot in 1929 and the very same hangar. From Trail, we went to Vancouver, and we phoned up Bob Randall, the guy who had flown it to Carcross in 1934. He was in his 90s. He was retired from captain, DC-8 captain with CPA. And he, in his wildest dreams, never thought he'd see that airplane again. Of course, he had flown it on that National Geographic expedition and right up through till 1937. When he left the airplane in 1937, he never thought he'd ever see it again because he had crashed out on Francis Lake, 200 miles from Carcross. He tore the gear off of it and broke the left wing, and the airplane was in pretty bad shape. And he upped and quit and moved on with his career. So it was a real treat to be able to get Bob out to the airplane. Of course, we took him flying in it. And we got some good videos of him telling us stories of when he used to fly it. So that was 2000. In 2001, we decided it's time to take AAM back to the Yukon. We named our journey 2001, a Yukon Odyssey. Now you can see the three of us here have been joined by a fourth guy on the left side there, Garth Pritchard, who's a professional documentary filmmaker. And he joined our team to document our flights and adventures with the Fokker. He had all the latest technology. He had the POV cameras that he taped on various parts of the airplane. So we did get some fabulous documentary footage. Anyway, this departure was a few months after Sean Luditz's famous rescue in Antarctica. Where are you, Sean? I saw you earlier tonight. Any pole, any time. Our documentary filmmaker thought it would make a great start for our trip to the Yukon to contrast the modern bush plane with the old Fokker Super Universal. So Sean joined us, brought his Twin Otter, and we blasted off, and Sean escorted us for a little ways to get some good film footage for our documentary man and also get us pointed in the right direction to get to the Yukon. Thank you, Sean, for that. And you can see he did a good job because here we are coming up on the Yukon. There's the Liard River. And again, I'm having to hurry this along because I don't want to keep you here all night. But after another four and a half noisy, hot hours, bugs splattering all over the windshield, Whitehorse finally came into view. So here we are in Downwind Lake at Whitehorse. And on the ground at Whitehorse, we got the airport manager to let us tear down 60 feet of the perimeter fence and taxi through to groundside so that we could host a reception of the airplane for a couple of days in front of the Transportation Museum. Some of you probably know Mike Stockstill. He's been an engineer with Air North since the beginning. And one of his passions is vintage cars. He joined our display with his beautiful 1937 Packard. And it just made for a great combination. We had a wonderful day and some interesting visitors. There's Tom Woods, the fellow who started Air North with Joe Sparling. There's our documentary filmmaker on the job. Any of you who've been to Old Crow will know Stephen Frost. He's a living legend in his own time. He came down to have a look at the airplane. Of course, he has seen aviation history up in Old Crow from the first airplanes to arrive there. And I don't imagine very many of you know Mo Grant, the Whitehorse crowd here will, but he was raised in Carcross during the heyday of Northern Airways and the Fokkers, and he remembered having his very first airplane ride in the Fokker Soup Universal. So he was pretty happy to sit in the cockpit and think back to when he was about 4 years old. Our first side trip out of Whitehorse was to head her back out into the St. Elias ice fields to go back to the site where it made history with the National Geographic in 1935. And of course, as always, the scenery out in that St. Elias country is absolutely spectacular. Now this shot, of course, taken in 1935. And I just want you to kind of take note of the that steep face there and this profile here, because I think it's recognizable in the next slide. We were on wheels, so we couldn't land to recreate the whole thing. We had to stay in the air, but we did find the right site. You can tell it's the same spot. Our documentary filmmaker had chartered a helicopter for camera ship, so he was able to get some great aerial shots of us over the ice fields. This is the Kaskawalsh Glacier. Some say it's the most photographed glacier in the world. I don't know, but it's pretty spectacular anyway. So at the end of that day, back into Whitehorse, and the next day we started the other part of our mission in going to the Yukon was to fly commemorative airmail to the places in the Yukon it used to haul airmail to back in the 30s. So here, once again, Mike Stockstill come through with another one of his vintage cars, this time the Model T. He's got the local postmaster with him, dressed in a period costume. And they backed their Model T up to the Fokker, and we loaded the mail. And then we blasted off for Points North. Our first port of call was Fort Selkirk. It's about halfway between Whitehorse and Dawson, and a very historic community. Hasn't been habitated for many years now, but it's being preserved by Parks Canada. So we made our low pass over the town. Fortunately, there was a guy there to take a picture. And then on to the airstrip, which would be the same one used way back by BYN and Grant McConachy and Northern Airways. It's still quite usable. So we hauled our mail into town. It's about almost a kilometer walk from the airstrip into town. The Dawson postmaster had dressed up in period costume and stamped the mail appropriately with the vintage cachets of the day and dated the envelopes and everything. And then we carried on to Dawson City. So here we're coming down the Klondike River Valley, and you can see the gravel tailing piles crisscrossing back and forth across the Klondike Valley. We saluted Dawson appropriately as we came around the corner. And in fact, we lucked out. We arrived, the whole town was in quite a festive mood. The commissioner was hosting his annual traditional commissioner's tea in front of the commissioner's mansion in Dawson. So we made a couple of low passes there and back and forth across the town, make sure everybody knew we'd arrived. And then we land at the airport, and there's the RCMP. And I thought, oh, this doesn't look too good. I thought they might be dressed up because if they're at the ball, and then, or at the tee, I should say, and then they might have thought maybe our low passes were a little more than they could tolerate. But it turns out they're nice guys. They're friendly guys. They just wanted our Royal Mail and to give us a ride into town, and then we just joined the festivities for the next 2 days. And of course, all too soon, we had to move on. The mail must go through, and now we're heading for the silver town of Mail in the central Yukon. Here's a picture of our airplane in 1935 on the river ice at Mail. And anyway, of course, we're on wheels, so we land at the airport, and I'll be damned if the RCMP weren't there again. But fortunately, again, just want the mail. And the real treat in Mayo was the four grade 12 girls that got gussied up in their can-can outfits. And that put a real nice touch to it. Clark even let them walk on that wing. He would never let anybody walk on the wing, but those girls were really, really something special. And we decided we took turns treating them each to a personalized tour of our cockpit. Anyway, I had to move on. The next port of call with the mail was Carcross, the old home base of AAM. So we're on short final here, the Carcross airstrip, and you can see the old Northern Airways hangar right there in the trees. Got her down safely once again. So here's the old Northern Airways hangar and one of their Fokkers being loaded in front of the hangar. We just threw that in for contrast, and it gave us special pleasure to taxi AAM up to the same hangar and take a picture. Are these pictures in focus? Okay, yeah, okay, they don't look so good from here. George Simmons himself, unfortunately, didn't live to see us return with AAM. This picture was taken in 1986 when I last visited with him and told him what we're doing, and he was good enough to sign off bills of sale for the carcasses of those airplanes so that with the rebuild, the paper trail could be intact all the way along from owner to owner to owner. So that was great, but he didn't live to, he did tell me, he was 86 years old when this picture was taken, and he said, "You boys, let me know when you're ready to fly that airplane so I can check you out on it," you know, so I wish he'd lasted long enough. Anyway, his little granddaughter, his little adopted granddaughter, she was proud to sit on the tire of Grandpa's airplane. And it made for a nice picture. The White Horse Star thought it was a nice picture anyway. So I took my buddies for a little walk around town. The old Northern Airways buildings are still there, but they're all boarded up. We did find one of their signs in fairly good shape. But we had to get back to business here and get the mail stamped in the post office. Now, the postmaster in Whitehorse tells me this is the longest continually serving post office in Canada. I find that hard to believe, but I guess, it's been running since the gold rush and it was never shut down. No postal strikes at that one, I guess. Anyway, time to move on again. And our next stop with the Royal Mail would be Atlin. So farewell to one and all. And here's the town of Atlin coming into view. And our low passes back and forth over the town were a little disappointing. Couldn't see any people. Nobody's waving to us. But of course, we found out we got to the airport. The whole town was at the airport. The RCMP were there, and they wanted the mail. A real highlight of the Atlin trip was letting Herman and Doris Peterson come out, visit the airplane and have a tour through it. They had come to Carcross in 1942 from Quebec as young newlyweds, and he had a brand new commercial pilot's license and wanted to be a bush pilot. So he hired on with Northern Airways. He had no experience. The first thing they did was put him in the Fokker, and he rode as a swamper in the right seat of the Fokker for his first 100 hours or so to learn the ropes. So it was pretty special for him to visit the Fokker again so many years later. And as you can see here in the lower right, we took him out for a ride too. Some of you in the room know Lyle Coleman. He was raised in Atlin, and this is his mother. She was into her 90s. She well remembered the early days of the Fokker Super Universals bringing the mail. So it was nice to visit her. She was well into her 90s when this picture was taken and still curling in Bonspiels. She's gone now. So that finished up the airmail. Counting Whitehorse, we'd made six stops, and this meant we had a big pile of letters that the museum could sell to stamp collectors and raise funds for the museum. So that worked out quite well. And then we headed south. The end of our the end of that that summer's flying. This is at Watson Lake where we overnighted and fueled up. And then the next day we carried on down the trench and through Rogers Pass and back to our little airstrip outside of Calgary. Kind of an iconic photo. It's two of the carcasses that we had stripped to help get AAM airworthy. The next year, 2002, I was flying in Ontario for that summer, so I wasn't flying the Fokker at all, but Don and Clark brought it to Yellowknife. I'm sure some of you were probably here and remember this. A familiar looking base. And there's our good friends, Willie and Paul Lazarick, having a good look at the airplane. Now, I didn't know whether by this time you'd be snoring and sleeping or your backside's getting sore. If you can take 8 more minutes, I'll show you we had one more grand adventure with AAM in 2003. The National Air Tour of 2003. A little bit of history background here. In 1926, the Ford Motor Company produced the best airplane in the world. Here they are in the car business, and they built one airplane, one type, and immediately leap ahead of everybody else. They build an airplane that's all metal. It's got multi-engines, closed cabin. Everybody else is still building airplanes out of wood and cloth. So Henry Ford was then only too proud to promote the airplane. He was a big promoter of aviation in general. Didn't like to fly himself, but he thought everyone else should fly. So he orchestrated these air tours starting in 1926, and he invited all the other aircraft manufacturers to bring their best airplanes, join him, and they would do these airborne showcase parades through the cities of the U.S. They would they'd map out the routing, and they'd publish it months ahead. They'd tell all the cities when they're going to get there, what time, what date. And there's no aerobatics involved. It was all in aid of proving the practicality of airplanes for moving people and mail and so on. No stunting, no barnstorming. So this went on 1926, 27, 28, right through to 1932, the air tour intended for 1932, and this was the routing, starting at Dearborn and going counterclockwise. But it never got off the ground. The Depression flattened everything, and they just didn't have the funding to carry it off. So in 2003, which the Americans considered to be the centennial of aviation, it was 100 years since the Wright brothers' flight, a multimillionaire friend of ours, who he made it big in computers, got in and got out at the right time, and his passion was these vintage airplanes, these golden age airplanes. He has a vast collection of them. And he likes to reenact historic things that these airplanes did. So to celebrate the centennial, he decided to put together a group of airplanes. You had to be 1932 or older. And we would fly the air tour of 32, the air tour that never got off the ground. It was by invitation only, and Don and Clark and I were the only non-Americans invited. In fact, lots of Americans wanted to go and weren't allowed to for whatever reason. So, of course, the reason was our airplane. It's a rare airplane. And in fact, Tony Fokker, back in the days of those air tours, had been an active participant. So, we had to relocate from Calgary to Detroit. And we all gathered together on an airport called Willow Run on the outskirts of Detroit. It's a historic airport from World War II because the Ford Motor Company built thousands of B-24 Liberator bombers on that airport. And the hangars and factory buildings were still there when we got there. So it was a good place for us to gather, to get together and get organized, get our briefings, and find out how we're going to do this. One of the things we did there is we were introduced to Edsel Ford. Edsel Ford the second or third. Historically, the original Edsel Ford had been a sponsor of these air tours, and he had always waved the white flag to each aircraft as they were cleared for takeoff to begin the air tour. And so to keep some of that history going again, he was seconded to do what his grandfather used to do with the original air tours. The fellow in the white t-shirt on the right is Greg Herrick. He's the multimillionaire who owns two hangars full of these old airplanes, and he's the guy that orchestrated the air tour. So here's our lineup. We're ready to head out on it. We were 2 weeks of flying. We visited 26 cities in 14 days. So you can see our airplane here. And I think there were 25 vintage airplanes, all of 1932 or earlier. And no, the B-52 did not go with us. So here you see Edsel Ford with his white flag, and he's waving each aircraft onto the runway. And for the next 2 weeks, we just lived the dream, flying alongside with airplanes we never dreamed you'd ever see at all, never mind see them flying. And we made a lot of wonderful friends, and we got to fly other people's airplanes. So, you know, I just had to keep pinching myself to see if I was just dreaming of all this. Each place we landed, there were big crowds waiting, because as I mentioned, it was always announced ahead of time and well publicized. They'd keep them behind the rope barrier there till the aircraft were fueled, and then they'd all come out in droves to look at the airplanes. We were particularly proud to be waving the Yukon flag. As well, our flight suits. We wore the Northern Airways flight suits, so we had Yukon blaring all over the place on our show. As you can see here, a lot of these people are not particularly aviation people, but they were very attracted to that big, ugly, old airplane with Yukon written all over it. Anyway, all too soon, of course, the air tour was over. I've had to give you real quick and dirty on this, but we're back now at Willow Run. A Goodyear blimp was arranged to be there to greet us. And in keeping with the traditions of the old air tours, we were presented with the bouquet. Each aircraft crew got a bouquet and a one of these trophies, which they used to give out, I guess, to all the participants back in the original air tours. And then we were ready to head back to Calgary. For us, the air tour itself was 4,500 miles, and the positioning, depositioning was another 4,000. So for us, this one 3 week trip was 8,500 miles. Oh yeah, I forgot to mention that once we decided we were going to go to Detroit, the Canadian National Exhibition in Toronto heard about it and got a hold of us and asked if we would leave early enough to go direct to Toronto and fly in the CNE air show each day. And they said if we would do that, they'd pay for all our gas from Calgary and put us up in a hotel room and give us a car. How could we turn all that down? So we did go straight to Toronto. And, of course, we joined the other air show aircraft on Toronto Island Airport. Here we see an earlier Fokker aircraft. There's actually two of them there. The Fokker triplanes, World War I, that the famous Red Baron used to fly when he was in mortal battle with Wap May and Snoopy. And of course, on the other side of our airplane was World War II Spitfire fighter, so we were in good company. Overhead is the Canadian Warbirds Lancaster, and just making his way out for his turn on the air show stage. It's mandatory that all pilots in the CNE air show wear life jackets. The whole air show takes place over Lake Ontario. And they've had some tragedies in the past, people ending up in the lake. So here we're just off the island airport and turning downwind to head out to the air show stage area, which is that bay that you can see here. They have a fireboat standing by down below, and we asked them to give us the full Monty, the full salvo of all his water cannons, while we did our graceful ballet back and forth in front of the crowd. Anyway, well, as you know, then we carried on to Detroit. And that's back at our home base. Our final mission with AAM was to deliver it to the Western Canada Aviation Museum. Now, I didn't get into that whole story, but they've actually ended up owning it along the way. I just quickly showed you me gathering the stuff up and Clark restoring it, but I did end up turning ownership over to them for various reasons. So it's now on display in Winnipeg, Western Canada Aviation Museum. Nobody else flies it. Clark and I are actually the only two that were flying it. We let lots of people steer it in the air so they put it in their logbook, but it looks like it'll never fly again. There's a little bit of talk of moving it to Whitehorse and this and that, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think it'll never fly again. But it's had a wonderful second life, second history. I'm going to leave you with this last slide. The man on the right is Rex Turpinning. He's a member of Canada's Aviation Hall of Fame. He's had a fabulous career. He was an AME all his life. Started his career in the 1930s flying out of Fort McMurray. In those days, the engineer always went with the aircraft. So he had a very adventurous life, and he's written a wonderful book called Bent Props and Blow Pots. So if you want to read the second best book about early Canadian bush flying, boy, I recommend you get a hold of that book. It's just a great book to read because he was there. He was doing it. He's not a braggart at all. He understates everything, but he's a very articulate man. In July of this year, Rex will be 100 years old. And he's still as sharp as a tack. And I am under strict orders to keep him posted on all these projects. Thank you.
Bob, that was excellent. We have a gift here from
No, that's
Nada.
Rod Wood's gift. That's Rod's present.
Oh, look, it's an Ulu hat.
Who's calling? Here we go. Oh, that's beautiful.
A license plate. Oh, wow.
And a book. This is on behalf of Northern Air Transport Association for honestly keeping the spirit alive. And that was a very cool story. Absolutely. Well, thank you on behalf of all of us.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. That's excellent.
That's great.
So we have to remember tomorrow morning, Bob is going to be signing out at the registration desk, I guess right here, right? So I do want to do a recap. Now, I don't know, here I go again. I don't know why I'm the issue with all this, but. Oh, here we go. I want to show this. It was brought to my attention that it, being a good liberal girl in the middle of Alberta, not like that stands out. Justin Trudeau, anybody? Yeah, anybody see that? Right on. Yeah. This was a wonderful evening, you guys. Big thanks, of course, to the Executive Director, Stephen Norris, and to Colin Dempsey. Thank you for everything here. We still have one more day to finish up. So I just want to say there's resolutions that should all be in now. And if you have something to turn in, to please do so immediately following the banquet. That sounds very strict. And tomorrow's going to be a big day. You know, I'm sure we all feel the loss of the presence of Don Douglas, that he has passed away. So tomorrow there will be a tribute that the board has organized in recognition of our Don Douglas. So that'll happen tomorrow at lunchtime. And I was just doing a little recap. I know we're looking at this picture. But our premier, Bob McLeod, he probably received the shortest ever intro that you will ever get ever. That was kind of fun. Yeah. Bob showed us amazing photos. That was a very cool story in the history, and it's people like you that keep it alive. So that's very cool that you're able to join us. And an amazing girl, Bally, who is the Ken Borick recipient. That's very impressive. And of course, Rod Wood receiving the Honorary Life Award, who, you know, we've had a couple of cocktails since that happened, because neither one of us were prepared to have that happen so early. But I'm looking forward to another match of a leg wrestling with Rod. I did win the first time, so we're looking forward to that later. The champ, Rod. So, anyways, that is it. Thank you to the Explorer Hotel, and we'll see you all tomorrow morning. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry, you guys. One more thing with Bob Cameron. He has, you know, come over to do his talk and show us the history and whatnot. And rather than paying him, Bob has asked that Northern Air Transport Association donate $1,000 in his name to his personal charity, which is going to the Yukon Transportation Museum, that NADA will be donating in your name for $1,000. So, there you go. Yeah.